Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Something that's been discussed a lot this year is what to do about parts of your past as a nation that might be considered embarrassing or shameful. In the United States, this is revolved around monuments, mostly Confederate monuments, whether statues of people like Robert E. Lee should be taken down. Some of them have been taken down by votes in a city, others have been taken down by protesters or rioters. And this isn't a new question. When I was in Hungary in the 2000s, I found out there's a really interesting park, park for monuments that are a collection of Soviet-era monuments of Stalin and Lenin and Marx that were taken out of Budapest and put in a place outside the city. They were removed after the end of the Cold War, but they weren't destroyed. They were just taken to another place where these monuments could be remembered, but they wouldn't be given a place of prominence within the city because people didn't want them there. But the question of a nation's own shameful past, what happens if it's something that you're trying to not only not exalt anymore, but forget and try to make it as if it never happened or completely wipe out the memory of it altogether? Well, we're going to look into an example of that in this episode, and we're going to go to a picturesque place in Austria called Obersalzberg. If you find a treat of Obersalzberg, it says, it's not just a peak, it's a treat. And to prove the point, it shows a snow-capped mountain peaks that rise over alpine landscape. And if you go there, you can golf, you can swim, you can raft, you can ski in the winter, or visit ancient salt mines that give this place its name. And it means Upper Salt Mountain. And it dates back far back into the Middle Ages. Here's one problem, though, with this area, especially a nearby resort, the Intercontinental Berchtesgaden. It sits on the plot of ground where the Nazi Reich Marshal Hermann Göring had his royal retreat, just over a rise from the Berghof. A luxurious house with a big picture window where Adolf Hitler contemplated the future of the Third Reich. This episode is dedicated to a question from listener Dane Carson, who says, for episode topics, I'd love to hear more about the history of Obersalzberg, primarily the role in World War II, tunneling into the mountainsides, its role as the second political headquarters for the Nazi Party, the construction and use of the Eagle's Nest, but also its history before that with Bavarian kings and what made the area so attractive. Well, Obersalzberg has a very interesting history, playing a very important political role in World War II, but also getting into the politics of memory, how we try to forget things out of our past and try to recraft a national narrative so things that represent values that we don't respect today can be removed. And that's what Obersalzberg is all about. And just a little bit more on recent history. In 2000, the Bavarian authorities tore down the Platterhof, the old hotel that was turned into a people's hotel during the Nazi years, and became an American recreation center after the war, during the American occupation of Germany, when Obersalzberg housed an American army contingent. The hotel was officially torn down because it was old and in bad condition, and it was unsuitable for use. But there was a worry and a strong suspicion among some Germans that The reason it was demolished was to obliterate anything that would spoil the atmosphere, and really to root out all physical traces of the Nazi regime. They largely accomplished that. Today in Ober-Salzburg, there's no physical contact with the past except for the Eagle's Nest, which is a residence on top of a mountain given to Adolf Hitler, and it's now a mountaintop resort accessible via the same elevator that Hitler used on his own rare visits to the place. This place where Hitler's house stood was bombed by the Allies in 1945 and cleared away in 1952, and now it's just been returned to forest. So in this episode, we're going to look at Ober-Salzburg and what it means to cleanse a region from its past. And first, I want to approach this issue conceptually instead of the details of Ober-Salzburg, what it comes to cleansing an area of its memory. We're going to step outside of the United States example or the German example and look at Norway. In Norway, historical monuments representing a shadowy use of the past, such as Nazi-era monuments raised in honor of Norse heroes, were destroyed to conceal or wipe out the history of Nazi occupation. And the Norse mythology was used by Nazis who were celebrating their Aryan past. Several of the monuments were raised during the war by a Norwegian far-right party that was active from 1933 to 1945. And many of them were destroyed after the war ended. We'll return to Norway, but let's jump back to Ober-Salzburg, specifically Hitler's summer residence. You can still find an entrance deep in the mountains of Bavaria, where there's a concrete doorway set into the side of the mountain. Even in the summer, the thick steel door is cool, and it drips with condensation. From the edges of the doorframe comes a cold breeze. Isn't marked on any tourist guide maps, as the government would prefer that people forgot about it. Behind the steel door is the underground secret bunker complex of Adolf Hitler. This entrance is an emergency entrance that's forgotten in the forest, and it's the exit also to Hitler's bunker beneath the Berghof. This multi-room subterranean compound consists of an apartment and a set of underground chambers for the fellow Nazi inner circle members, and it also consists of over 4 miles of tunnels, bunkers, and hidden rooms in total. Above ground, an entire village was built as an alpine retreat for the Nazi government. When the war was falling apart for the Nazis, the underground complex became the last place of refuge of the Third Reich. It was carpet bombed by the RAF, the Royal Air Force, in April of 1945, then locked up by the US Army. It was then handed back over to Germany in 1952, but it was done so with the requirement that the remnants be blown up again out of existence. But not everything was destroyed, the underground complex wasn't, and today you can visit the secret ruins of the Nazi-planned Alpine Fortress. And nearby is the small village, or the town, of Berchtesgaden. It's one of the prettiest in Europe, and it's surrounded on all sides by the Alps, and marked by domed church steeples, and terracotta-tiled houses, and flowers, and beer gardens. And there's a river that also runs right through the center of the town. Above the market town of Berchtesgaden in Bavaria is Ober-Salzburg. It's located about 75 miles southeast of Munich, close to the border with Austria, and here is situated the Berghof and the mountaintop Eagle's Nest. The name of the settlement derives from the rock salt deposits of the former Prince Provostry of Berchtesgaden. Salt mining in this area was documented since the 12th century, and a major salt mine opened in 1517. It was destroyed in 1834, but rebuilt and named the Old Salt Works. The layout of some components of the salt mining operation still exist. The area was mentioned in the first land registry of 1456, and it was ruled by an Augustinian abbey. The area was annexed by Austria in 1805, and then ruled by France in 1809 to 1810 after the Napoleonic Wars. And after these wars, Berchtesgaden and the salt mines were secularized, taken out of control out of the abbey, and passed to the Kingdom of Bavaria in 1810. Salzburg was then reestablished as a Bavarian municipality in 1817. There were plans by Nazi authorities to merge it with Berchtesgaden, but they weren't carried out, and Salzburg wasn't incorporated into Berchtesgaden until 1972. The final scene in The Sound of Music, where the von Trapp family are escaping into what is depicted to be Switzerland, takes place here as well. Here's how it became Hitler's retreat. In 1877, Mauritia Mayer, a pioneer in alpine tourism, opened a boarding house in Ober-Salzburg. In the late 19th century, German intellectuals and artists, people like Johannes Brahm, Peter Rosiger, and others, and industrialists as well, began using the area as a summer and winter vacation. The Obersalzberg boarding house was leased to a racing driver, Bruno Buchner, in the early 1920s. And when he acquired the property in 1928, he renamed it Platterhof, inspired by a novel popular at the time. The landscape and mountain views also attracted Adolf Hitler, who in 1923 was visiting his fellow party member and anti-Semite, Dietrich Eckart, at the Obersalzberg boarding house, shortly before the Bierhall Putsch and the imprisonment in Landsberg. It was in a cabin on these premises where, after he was released from custody in 1925, he dictated part two of Mein Kampf, which earned him huge royalties. Well, he became so fond of the area that by 1928, he used his royalty income to rent a small chalet nearby called Haus Wachenfeld. And here he put his half-sister, Angela Rabal, in charge of the household together with her daughter, Geli. By the time of his appointment as Chancellor of Germany in 1933, Hitler was fairly wealthy. He'd earned roughly 1.2 million Reichsmarks in royalties from Mein Kampf. The average teacher of a salary in 1933 was around 4,000 marks, to give you an idea. So with his wealth, he began to build a mansion not far from a small cabin in the mountain retreat of Obersalzberg, called the Berghof, and it was completed in 1935. Hitler's home was imposing. It was also luxurious. It was dominated with a 25-foot picture window, which looked onto the mountains of his native Austria. Several months after the Nazi seizure of power in January 1933, Hitler purchased Wachenfeld and began making a number of renovations. The first included window shutters and a small office, then a winter garden and stonework. And finally, the most extensive renovations came from 1935 to 1936, when the chalet was transformed into a huge house with extensions. There was a bowling alley in the cellar, a huge window that could be lowered to provide a panoramic view of the Alps. And the house became known as Berghof, or Mountain Court in English. Other buildings in the area were the Eagle's Nest, atop a summit. It was a rocky outcrop, and the Eagle's Nest was used for Nazi party meetings and to host dignitaries. But the building had no beds in it. It was given to Adolf Hitler in 1939 on his 50th birthday, but he only visited on 14 occasions. Many think that he had a fear of heights, and Eva Braun actually used it more frequently. The window was chosen deliberately by Hitler because he loved Aryan myth so much and saw himself as the fulfillment of Germanic potential. There's one legend that Charlemagne, the unifier of Western Europe, slept in these mountains and was waiting for the next leader to rule Germany. So Hitler is the fulfillment of that. If Bismarck was the Second Reich, then Hitler's Third Reich was supposed to take the mantle of Charlemagne and fulfill the promise of unifying all of Europe and rule for 1,000 years. So the phrase thousand-year Reich, this wasn't just chosen haphazardly, but it had to do with myth about Charlemagne. Hitler spent about a third of his time in power at Berghof. He entertained people like David Lloyd George, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, Mussolini, Neville Chamberlain. And it was here in this location where Hitler decided to annex Austria and invade Czechoslovakia and kick off the Second World War. The Eagle's Nest was set about 6,000 feet high. If you want to reach the Eagle's Nest and you don't have access to Hitler's private elevator, you can reach it by Germany's highest altitude road. At the end of the road, a tunnel was bored into the mountainside that ends in a solid brass elevator. The elevator, which still runs today, would have carried Hitler to his mountaintop retreat. Starting in around 1936, leading figures in the Nazi Party began building similarly large homes in Berghof to be near Hitler. Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary and head of the party chancellery, was in charge of the project, which entailed clearing Obersalzberg of farms and inns and hotels that had catered to generations of holidaymakers. And this was sort of a land development for new houses that were at the top of the Nazi Party. Soon, Goering, Himmler, Hess, Joseph Goebbels also had huge mansions built. A children's asthmatic clinic that was there in the mountains that provided children with asthma clear mountain air to heal and recuperate was occupied and turned into a house for Bormann himself. Obersalzberg became a village community for about 2,000 high-ranking Nazis and their families. Up there also was a bowling alley, a cider press, a cinema, a model farm, outdoor swimming pools, a kindergarten, and beekeeping places for honey. A workers' camp for highly paid Italian laborers and experts in mountain road building was constructed. Hitler's architect, Albert Speer, kept a design studio in a valley that featured a huge luxury hotel on the overlooking ridge called the Platterhof. By 1943, when the Allies were pushing into North Africa and Italy, it made the threat of imminent air raids a possibility, and it cast a shadow over this area, so this community was no longer an idyllic mountain retreat. The Nazis started to burrow deep into the mountains for safety. The principal Nazi mansions soon had matching subterranean apartments spreading out from their basements as bunkers. They were linked by a 4-mile-long tunnel system. Facilities for stormtroops and secretaries and medical staff and families were also established underground. These dwellings were similar to the homes above them, complete with a ventilation system, dehumidifiers, and central heating. Göring's bunkers contained a huge collection of rare wines and champagnes and spirits and priceless art that was seized. This was the Nazis' Alpine Fortress. It was considered a national zone of retreat where Hitler and his inner circle could conduct the grand finale, the final stage of the war effort. Germany's enemies eventually got wind of the complex thanks to aerial surveillance photography carried out between 1943 and 1945. Allies knew about the mansions, and the British Secret Service had been formulating plans to assassinate Hitler. But the huge underground earthworks being carried out at Ober-Salzburg were mysterious. No one exactly knew how extensive the tunneling was, or they didn't have maps or anything like that. Some of the Allies thought that this wasn't just a holding bunker, but actually a gigantic manufacturing system and a place for arms manufacturing, especially for Germany's atomic bomb, which Germany was working on, and I did a whole episode on this, but they really never got far past the development stage because there was never a unified effort for building the atomic bomb like a Manhattan Project. In April 1945, hundreds of Lancaster bombs from the Royal Air Force left northern Italy to obliterate the mansions of Ober-Salzburg and also anything that was going on underground. The air raid missed the eagle's nest, but devastated the rest of Ober-Salzburg and destroying most of the buildings, including Berghof. But they did do a good job building the mountain defenses, the Nazis, because of the 2,000 inhabitants taking refuge in their bunkers, only 6 died. So they performed their function of protecting against air raids. Weeks later, the French and U.S. Army took what was left of the model Nazi village and the Eagle's Nest. And you can see this in the HBO series Band of Brothers, where Easy Company, part of the 101st Airborne, come in and occupy the Eagle's Nest, and some troops took ownership of Hitler's private possessions. The U.S. remained on the mountain until as recently as 1996. For different reasons, but there was always a concern among the Allies years and decades after the war that they had to occupy what was considered to be Nazi holy sites so there wouldn't be any type of resurgence of Nazi ideology and make sure that denazification was complete. What survived from the air raid was reappropriated. The luxury hotel became the Hotel General Walker. Speer's studio and home became a private residence, as did some of the surviving SS barracks. Eagle's Nest became a restaurant and a beer garden in the 1950s. It's only open today in the summer months due to the dangers of avalanches, and it attracts up to 3,500 people a day. Well, if you look at it today, there's only 2 signs, one in German, the other in English, that mark the mountainside location of Berghof, Adolf Hitler's retreat in the Bavarian Alps, which acted not only as a retreat center, but if I didn't make this clear earlier, it was the Third Reich's second seat of command. The site on Ober-Salzburg has been largely abandoned since the bomb-damaged chalet was finally blown up and buried in 1952 and replaced by fast-growing trees in the forest, which were planted to hide from view even the soil that Hitler once walked on. In 1999, a small museum, the Documentation Ober-Salzburg, which chronicles all the evils committed by the Nazi regime, it was opened about 300 yards from the Berghof site in an attempt to stop the area of becoming a shrine or a pilgrim site for fascist or far right or whoever. But some people still did keep coming. There are information signs that are defaced, swastikas have been carved into trees, and lit candles were left on a perimeter wall and a fireplace that made up the few remaining ruins. There's an article in The Guardian I'll link to in the show notes, and it notes that one journalist interviewed museum staffers there, and they noticed that in recent years, there were coach tours from Hungary and the Czech Republic where groups thought to be far right started to arrive and visit this area. So the Documentation Ober-Salzburg was completed in the summer of 2020, and it tried to document the horrors as much as possible to make people aware of what happened at Berghof. Right now, there's only a small stony path through the trees that links the museum to the area of unkept ground where the Berghof stood above the town of Berchtesgaden. Dr. Matthias Ehrlinger, who has worked at the museum since 2004, when he thinks about this question that we're looking at in this episode of how to deal with the past, whether we wipe it from the face of the earth or try to recontextualize it, says that when it comes to places like these, we shouldn't turn a blind eye. He said, if you do nothing to an area, they can do what they want. He said, if you just say here lived Hitler, that's a problem. Some people want to leave it as it is. Others think an audio tour or more is appropriate. The more people who are around here, the less likely they will get out their flags. The far right has to go to places which are hidden away. The museum is currently a two-story exhibit built on a former guest house from where there's an entrance to 4 miles of tunnels and bunkers constructed in the period right at the end of the war to protect Hitler and his entourage from Allied bombs. And as construction workers dug into the hill, they actually found undetonated bombs. So there's a good chance there's probably more. The buildings had to have been evacuated a few times during construction, so bomb experts could go in and make sure it was safe.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.
What Ehrlinger said the purpose of the museum was is to connect the pictures of Hitler drinking tea and playing with his dog and going to opera in Salzburg with the decisions he made between photo shoots to launch a war effort and kill millions. So there's a delicate balance between the historic importance of places like this and a compulsion to wipe it from the face of the earth. Presumably, this is what led the U.S. to insist that Germany dynamite the surviving structures of Ober-Salzburg in 1952. Museums and documentation centers were built at Ober-Salzburg and Nuremberg. And at Ober-Salzburg, which all Munich school children are required to visit, along with a trip to Dachau, it speaks to Germany's commitment to understand the evils of Nazi Germany. And the documentation center also opened up a small stretch of the tunnels, but not the whole 4 miles. And just a little bit more about the tunnels, because it's interesting what they were designed for beyond just protection. The surface of the tunnels begin about 200 feet under the ground. These passageways would have linked Bormann's underground chambers directly to Hitler's rooms underneath the Berghof. Today, it's lined with little stalactites because they're dripping with condensation, and the air is cold and undisturbed. If the Reich had fallen and it had survived in some ways, it was from here that the war had been plotted while the rest of Germany burned, and maybe some Nazis would have tried to escape or reform somewhere else and start a Fourth Reich. And security was very important. At the end of each tunnel and stairwell, there was a further hidden chamber built behind the wall where a heavy machine gun team lay in wait for intruders. Further down into the heart of the mountain is a room with tiled remains of a bathtub. This was the underground quarters of Hitler's bodyguard. The wall next to the subterranean barracks is mostly and crudely bricked up. Scrawled on the wall in paint says, "Access to Hitler's house and private rooms," written by owners to help explorers navigate the labyrinth of tunnels. Some of the tunnels have been waterlogged and decrepit due to decades of neglect, But when U.S. troops first entered it, they found all sorts of Hitler's mementos, bottles of wine, bottles of champagne, hoards of silver, shelves full of works of art from the galleries of Europe, and many mementos from the bunker, including Hitler's personal folio of Shakespeare, found their way back to mantelpieces in America. A week before the Allies took Obersalzberg, the SS started to burn sensitive documents in huge fires. These included Hitler's old diaries and notebooks and confidential letters from his relations that he kept away from the public eye. One U.S. soldier discovered in the ashes a notebook called Ideas and Creation of a Greater German Reich, and others found vials of bottles of cocktail of drugs that Hitler had been prescribed near the end of the war due to his onset of what is probably Parkinson's disease. So Hitler ultimately never retreated to his mountain sanctuary, and he decided to remain in Berlin, where he committed suicide. And when the Allies reached Berchtesgaden and Obersalzberg, they mostly found it deserted because anyone who was there would very clearly be involved in the Nazi Party and couldn't deny it. Those who were located there were able to escape through an old 12th century salt mining trail into the mountains. So to wrap things up, going back to the question of what to do with the past, some people talk about cleansing the past as similar to the Taliban's destruction of Buddha statues in Afghanistan, or the demolition of Saddam Hussein's statues in Iraq after the U.S. invasion, or the destruction of Lenin and Stalin statues after the fall of the communist regime. But others argue that tearing down a Buddha statue to demonstrate religious intolerance and the demolition of a dictatorial statue to demonstrate democracy are very different. There are different contexts, and the legitimacy of each one is different. So history and memory, I would argue, aren't the same thing. You don't need a Hitler statue to remind you of the history of the Second World War. And removing a memorial doesn't remove history, but the act changes how it will be remembered. Now, I did a Civil War series with James Early, and we argued that Civil War statues or Confederate statues shouldn't be torn down by mobs, but it's always up to the local community to decide what they do with them, because what a statue means in one place can mean something very different in another place. And we gave the example of a university in Ghana decided to take down a statue of Mahatma Gandhi because they looked at statements that Gandhi had made in the past that were not very complimentary of Africans and decided that he didn't represent their values there. But in a completely different country, a statue of Gandhi would be appropriate. So there's never a cookie cutter answer to these questions. Anyway, that's the story of Obersalzberg. Thank you for the question. And that is an example of how they have tried to reconcile with their past. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion. All right. Well, that is all I have to say for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Dalton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, or I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Dalton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.
After Teddy Roosevelt's failed third-party presidential run, he thought that he would reassemble the Rough Riders for a final charge against the Germans in World War I by launching a cavalry attack against 50-caliber machine guns. Here's an interview with Bill Hazelgrove to look at this incredible story.
Teddy Roosevelt was one of these people who seemed indestructible. And that's why I think a lot of Americans wanted him to go, because in a way, he was their Superman.
To listen to this full interview, check out the History Unplugged podcast on the podcast player of your choice.